Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. A young bride drowns in her bathtub. Her husband of 4 months is accused of murder. What happened in their tiny suburban bathroom and why was never resolved. A compelling true crime drama based on exclusive new information, Submerged exposes hidden angles of a case that captivated and divided an ordinary American community, tore apart two families, and tested the criminal justice system. Compelled by conscience and curiosity, former Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Janice Morse Heisel, who covered the saga of Ryan and Saren Widmer from the start, returns 10 years later to dig deep to tell the untold story. Dozens of interviews, 6,000 pages of trial transcripts, and previously unrevealed records such as Ryan's first written statement about Sarah's death, attorney's notes and trial preparation documents, Ryan's personal journal, notes and correspondence, more than 1,000 pages of police notes and reports, Submerged will draw you into the depth of a stranger-than-fiction story that you will ponder long after turning the final page. The book that we're featuring this evening is Submerged, Ryan Widmer, His Drowned Bride and the Justice System, with my special guest journalist and author, Janice Heisel. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Janice Heisel.
Thanks, Dan. It's good to be on the show.
Thank you so much. Incredible story, and already I had not known of this case. I see that this has an incredible following right from the very beginning of this case in 2008. Yes, August 11, 2008.
Yeah, it's hard to believe it's been 10 years, more than 10 now.
Absolutely. Let's talk about where this crime is and story is centered, which is Cincinnati, Ohio. And would you talk about the Hopewell Valley subdivision and a little bit of some of the communities that are involved in this? Set the stage for where the community that this occurred, where in Cincinnati, and tell us a little bit about this Hopewell Valley subdivision.
Sure. Okay, so Hopewell Valley is kind of an ordinary, mostly vinyl and brick houses, you know, valued around maybe $100,000, $200,000, kind of, you know, nice starter homes. And Ryan and Sarah actually had built a house there together before they got married, or actually they bought a house that was already constructed. And one of the reasons that I became so enthralled with this case is that this subdivision is near where I live, which is right about 45 minutes north of Cincinnati, Ohio. It's kind of a smallish town, and a lot of people started to wonder whether, quote-unquote, small-town justice was at work here, because it was a smaller police department. They only had one detective to investigate this unusual death, and that was part of what kind of wrapped everybody into this. This is a weird way to die, drowning in a bathtub, age 24. How does this happen when there's no sign of drugs in her body or around the scene? There was no sign of an intruder. Husband must have done it. Seemed kind of like an open and shut case right from the start. But the more people found out about this, the less that seemed true in some people's minds.
Now, tell us, you were a news reporter. Tell us who you were working for at that time and the website as well that you worked on. And tell us how you heard first of this story and what you did actually hear about it.
Okay, yes. Yeah. So I worked for the Cincinnati Inquirer, and the website is known as cincinnati.com. And it was my job to keep tabs on everything happening in a couple of counties in the northern suburbs, both Butler and Warren counties. Warren County is where this particular incident occurred and happens to be where I live. So I remember hearing, as part of my job, I would make regular checks with various sources, police, coroner's office, secretaries, people like that, oftentimes by phone because my territory was so big. But I remember hearing a little bit of scuttlebutt, just there was something weird that happened down the road. But nobody would really come out and tell me exactly what this was at first. And then finally, we heard that maybe it was a drowning. And if I recall correctly, one of my editors said, well, let's just wait and see what happens. And then, sure enough, the next day after we first heard about it is when this press conference was called. And the media just flocked to this small courthouse so we could hear what was this mysterious case. Because it wasn't very often that you would hear about any kind of incident that of a big consequence in this little town. In fact, this was the first, quote-unquote, fresh homicide in a decade in this community.
Now, you talk about right away in that press conference that Rachel Hutzel, a prosecutor, and Lieutenant Jeff Braley. What's surprising about this to you and other people that are seasoned reporters? What's unusual about this, and what is the content of what they have to say in this? Who is tell us about those.
Well, one of the unusual things was, I remember in the press release, there was a statement along the lines of, you know, we won't be answering questions, you know, until way after this press conference or something to that effect. That, so kind of like if you wanted to get this news, you had to physically be there. I remember something along those lines. And what was very unusual about the content of the press conference was the prosecutor and the detective, Jeff Braley, both kind of concurred that there was evidence of a violent struggle at this scene. And that was the thing that left everybody really wondering, what was this mystery evidence? Now, I was kind of known for being that annoying reporter at the press conference who wouldn't let the public officials off very easily. So I kept grilling them and saying, well, how did you, you know, was this something obvious? Was it at the scene? Well, it was something that required the skills of the coroner to reveal. And I thought, wow, so it wasn't something on the outside of the body. It was something on the inside of the body. What could that be? And that was the thing that made everybody wonder really deeply about, what is this mystery evidence of a violent struggle?
Now, as you are clamoring and others are clamoring for information, the prosecution is going ahead. So who are these members of the prosecution? And tell us some of the players that line up soon after, investigative-wise and prosecution and defense-wise.
Okay. So, again, because of my role in being the what we call cops in courts reporter covering these suburban communities, it was my job to know some of the movers and shakers, the people who tended to make headlines when there were headlines to be made. Again, some of these communities kind of small and not a lot of really big, shocking crime going on. So Rachel Hutzel, the county prosecutor, she was someone who she really kind of catapulted up the ranks in the county government. It was kind of unusual, I hate to say this, the kind of the good old boy network for a female. She became the first female prosecutor in this county, and a lot of people thought that she had a lot of ambitions to become a judge, and she eventually did become a judge. Now, I had a very good relationship, I would say, a very good working relationship with both Rachel Hutzel and with the lead investigator, Jeff Braley. Now, neither of them were the kind of people that I would, you know, go out with socially or anything. This was a professional relationship. They were my trusted sources. However, in Rachel's case, she played a lot of things very close to the vest, and I had a hard time ever getting her to really go off the record and speak candidly to me. But Jeff, on the other hand, he was somebody who, even though he worked for a very small police department, he was somebody who I had the impression, and so did many other people, that he kind of liked being in the limelight when he could be. And he was actually a very good interview, and I considered our relationship to be pretty what I would call symbiotic, meaning, hey, I need stories. He wants to be in them and give good quotes. So that's a good relationship when you're a news reporter. Jeff also, it was kind of interesting. He was a minister on the side, and in fact, his role as being a minister was what led him to be on the police department, as odd as that might sound. Jeff had been the chaplain for the local fire department, and that kind of his responsibilities morphed over the years until he became part of the police department. And there are a whole lot of questions that were raised, especially later. I didn't know him very well until he ascended higher into the ranks, about how that happened. So it was kind of an interesting progression from his career.
Tell us, as you write in the book, a little bit about Ryan Widmer and also Sarah Stewart. Tell us about how they met, but first a little bit about their backgrounds, who they were.
Okay.
And what you found.
So I had no idea who these people were, and in fact, most people had no idea who these people were until after all of this brought them out into the public eye, unwittingly, of course. So I'll start with Sarah. She actually seemed like the kind of person I would have loved to have known, because I tend to be kind of a little bit of a social butterfly and state my opinion fairly strongly when I have one. And it sounded like she was like that as well. It was just sad to me that I never got to know her. And the more I spoke to people, the more I had wished I had had the opportunity to know her. She was described as being very feisty, but also had a little bit of sweetness to her, the kind of person who would make cookies for someone who was sick or at Christmas time or whatever, just a sweet touch to her, but don't cross her kind of thing. And she grew up in a town called Trenton, near Trenton, Ohio, where there's like the Miller Brewery. It's kind of very blue-collar area. And likewise, Ryan Widmer, who later became her husband, he grew up in a very blue-collar community as well. But his was a larger blue-collar community known as Coleraine Township. And again, this is on the west side of Cincinnati. And Ryan was a very talented athlete from what I've heard. He was the kind of guy, after I got to talk to him, that doesn't like to kind of toot his own horn very much. But a lot of people thought he was a pretty talented athlete. He ended up going to college and playing baseball in college. And that is where he met a man named Chris Kist. And Chris was his college roommate. And Chris was married to a woman named Dana. Well, Dana ends up working with Sarah Stewart at a dental office, and Sarah and Dana became very good friends. So Dana and her husband, Chris, thought, you know what? Their personalities, Ryan and Sarah's personalities, are very similar to ours, where Ryan's kind of reserved and laid back, and you know, Sarah's more feisty, and likewise, the same could be said of Chris and Dana. And they thought, well, since we get along so well, they're both single. Why don't we play matchmaker? So they kind of arranged a safe double date, so to speak, in case it didn't work out. It was the four of them went out to have a few drinks and some appetizers kind of thing. And they were amazed to see how well that Ryan and Sarah really hit it off from the start.
Right. Now, you talk about that it was a whirlwind of romance. It was soon after that he was proposing for marriage, and that was a very interesting, I guess, and very romantic story as well. Tell us a little bit about this marriage and what the families thought of each other, and a little bit about the families, some of the members, but what each thought of this union.
Well, from what I understand, the families, you know, they didn't know each other super well at the time that this couple got married, but they seemed to get along just fine from everything that I had gleaned from interviews after the fact. There were some records that I was able to obtain later that started to give me some insight that Sarah's mother may not have been entirely thrilled with the idea of her daughter marrying Ryan, and it didn't seem like there was anything personality-wise or relationship-wise that she didn't like, but rather, according to the documents that I saw, she expressed misgivings that her daughter was making more money than her husband-to-be and kind of had a belief, I think, that the man should be the breadwinner. As far as I could tell, though, the families got along pretty well. In fact, very well. There was never any, no one ever brought to my attention any kind of friction between these families. And it seemed to be two big happy families melding together as a result of this romantic wedding. And, you know, people were thrilled. The wedding pictures show a lot of exuberance and joy. And it was really sad later on for me to get to see those and know what the eventual outcome would be only 4 months after that wedding day.
Yeah. Tell us about the 911 call from Ryan Widmer, August 11th of that year. What was said?
Well, on this 911 call, the very first thing that is stated by Ryan Widmer after the dispatcher answers 911, what is your emergency? Ryan says, my wife fell asleep in the bathtub and I think she's dead. That particular sentence and the fact that it was the first thing that he said automatically set off a bunch of alarm bells, so to speak, questions as to why would you offer a quote-unquote explanation or excuse instead of giving more information, the excuse being that she fell asleep in the bathtub. And what a seemingly preposterous thing to say. But then it might not seem as preposterous if you're a reporter like I am and you start to talk to friends and they tell you that they were concerned about Sarah's health, that she would fall asleep in odd places. They would say, what kind of 24-year-old woman falls asleep at a tailgate party in the daytime and also in a crowded football stadium? And Dana Kiss, the coworker who ended up playing matchmaker, she even testified on the witness stand that Sarah would go into a darkened room to try to ease her headaches. She would get these terrible headaches and see spots. And the day that she died, Dana was no longer working there, but that very day, everyone at the dental office said that Sarah didn't feel well, that she had this odd pain in the back of her neck and that her stomach was upset. And some people might see that as being, those are kind of everyday complaints, maybe not anything sinister. However, there are a lot of people who are familiar with seizures, and they say people who have seizures can develop what's called an aura or a collection of symptoms that let the person know, hey, I'm about to have a seizure now. They become familiar with this aura. But what if this was a first-time incident, or maybe the things that were happening to Sarah were mini seizures, all of those sleepiness incidents and the headaches and whatnot. So, again, what seemed like maybe a little bit of a clear-cut case for some people, if you start to layer onto that the facts that were coming out about Sarah, maybe not.
What were some of the things? You talk about first responders at a scene and in many, many cases that we talk about on True Murder, it really is first responders that question the veracity of that person's account of what happened and based on some of the evidence that's right before their eyes. What do first responders find in this case? What are some of their questions?
Well, one of the things that became almost like a mantra during Ryan Widmer's court case was her hair was wet, her body seemed dry. Also, the scene seemed surprisingly dry for a person who had reportedly just been pulled out of a bathtub filled with water. Again, however, as odd as all of that sounds and as suspicious as all that sounds, what if there's an explanation for that? Ryan Widmer would later provide that explanation, and his lawyers would, through some documents that I saw. But that was a fact that didn't come out until the case went to trial about the dryness of the scene. They kept that under wraps pretty well.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about what happens, because right away they put this case, as you write, is explodes in the media. There's so much interest. You talk about Ryan's bail being $1 million. Tell us what happens in that. Is he forced to stay in prison? What about the $1 million bail? Tell us about that.
Well, what was absolutely heartbreaking and to me very touching, poignant, dramatic was at Ryan's first court hearing, members of Sarah's family were there and begging the judge to let him out so he could go to her funeral, so they could have a funeral for her. And that didn't happen. And then the next court appearance, very similar thing. You know, we have the brother of Sarah saying, you know, in our heart of hearts, I still remember this quote, in our heart of hearts, we don't think he did this. We don't believe he did this. That really struck with me. It was a very touching and sad thing to have the brother, the only brother of this reported victim of homicide up there saying, hey, we want this guy out. We don't think he did it. And so eventually the bond did get released to about $400,000, if I recall correctly, which right. then was enough for the family to put together. You have to put together like a 10% of that.
Yeah.
And he was allowed out, but get this, he was released just a couple hours too late. They delayed the memorial service and they were trying to get him there, but he was released a couple hours too late to attend.
Yeah. Pretty sad. Yeah, absolutely. Now, what was the theory from Rachel Hutzel and the prosecution? What was their summary of what, there was some mystery evidence, as you write, that wasn't going to be revealed till that trial, but what was their basis? What did they assert?
Well, when you say theory, that's kind of hard to pin down because the theories seemed to shift as the case progressed in court, which was very strange to me as a reporter. Usually I see the prosecution and the defense kind of dig their heels into this is our theory of the case, this is our version of what happened. And in this case, there were changes that were kind of surprising that occurred. Now, the evidence that was referred to as being quote unquote evidence of a violent struggle, I write in my book that I remembered thinking, well, maybe her head was kind of like bashed in and you couldn't see it because her hair covered up the damage or, you know, something like that. I thought it was going to be something very, very dramatic and clear cut, undeniable. This guy is going straight to prison. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. He was going to prison. But when it came out in court, the coroner said that what he thought was evidence of a violent struggle was actually bleeding inside her neck and upper chest area. And he said he believed that there were actually two areas of bleeding, one that was attributable to a needle stick that the paramedics made in her neck to try to start an IV. But the other part, he says, was most likely the result of force, somebody forcing her into the water by grabbing her in the neck/chest area. Now, the interesting thing, though, about that is it depends whose expert you believe. The defense put on an expert witness who is actually world-renowned, Dr. Werner Spitz. And Dr. Spitz wrote what is considered to be the quote-unquote Bible of forensic death investigation. And he actually came in unbeknownst to the prosecution and did a second autopsy after the coroner's autopsy on Sarah Widmer. He said he didn't think there was any way to determine the manner of death. Now, a lot of people confuse manner of death and cause of death. In this case, the cause of death, no one disputes, is drowning. There was water in the lungs, and that's the cause. But the manner, was it accidental? Did she slip and fall? Did she have a seizure? Or was it homicide, which is what that coroner ruled it. However, Dr. Right. Spitz said, wait a minute, not so fast. He believed, remember that area in the neck that I mentioned? He believed that all of the bleeding in that neck area was attributable to the attempt to save her life with that IV, that it was one area of bleeding, not two. One cause, the IV, not two. So that was a very interesting conflict, and there was actually no sign of trauma whatsoever on the outside of Sarah Widmer's body, which was another very odd thing. Her nails, her elbows, her knuckles, her knees, no damage, no sign of struggle there. So I was kind of expecting, you know, something more dramatic, something bigger, other than this neck injury, which is disputed, and disputed by an expert that a lot of people would say was extremely credible. So, again, which expert do you believe?
You talk about added credibility. He had written what they call the Forensic Bible, basically a very revered book on forensic procedures and in his realm of expertise. So it lended to, and you talk about the thousands of cases that he worked on. So his credibility did seem to, as you write in this book, seem to favor the defense in that regard.
Right. And in contrast, the defense attorneys did eventually point out that the county coroner didn't have board certification. So they're contrasting their guy's credentials against the local guy's credentials. However, it seems like that from the interviews that I did later, that maybe the forensic evidence didn't matter that much to the jurors.
You also talk about, though, that that there was dramatic things that the prosecution did, like bring in the entire tub into the courtroom, and merely for dramatic effect. And you talked about some of the ways that they sort of bent the same information that someone else, obviously the defense, contended. Tell us a little bit more about some of the issues that were in contention at this trial.
Well, as I mentioned about the wet hair, dry body, dry conditions, the prosecution's argument is, hey, that's all suspicious. My goodness, how in the world does it happen that a drowning victim has only her head wet and the rest of her body seems dry within a few minutes of the 911 call was when the original first responders arrived, the police and paramedics. But they found, the police officers found, no evidence of cleanup. They went to the laundry. They found that there were no freshly dried towels in the dryer, for instance, that neither of the car's engines or hoods were hot, indicating that maybe that the evidence was taken away from the scene. So there were no wet towels found anywhere. So the defense version of this is, this was a silent slipping into the water, not a violent death. And that explains why there's not water splashed everywhere. If this is a violent struggle, as you contend, Mr. and Ms. Prosecutor, then water would have been splashed everywhere, correct? So there are so many things about this case that you look at it one way and you go, wow, that looks really bad. But then you hear the explanation and you start to wonder, wow, that sounds like that's actually plausible as well. Having been a reporter for, gosh, over 20 years, I would see defense lawyers make arguments that I would call BS on. I would like, no. But in that case, that made a lot of sense to me, and I think to a lot of people who followed this case closely. So that was, you know, again, the wetness versus the dryness. As you mentioned about the bathtub being brought into the courtroom, it was very interesting to me as I began to research this book. I didn't know until I researched the book that the defense knew that the seizure of the bathtub by the authorities was actually probably not legal, but they chose not to fight that at the time because they didn't want the headline in the newspaper or online to say defense tries to hide evidence. And so it was actually a tactical decision for the defense to not fight the inclusion of the bathtub. But as I bring out in my book, I really believe that that bathtub just became such a tangible, visible piece of evidence that the jurors would play over in their head what happened in that tub, what happened in that tub. And without that bathtub being there, pretty much staring at people, if a bathtub can stare, that they may not have felt as strongly as they did about the handprints in the bathtub. And I know you know about the finger streaks that were found in the bathtub. And sure. The inclusion of the bathtub and the finger streaks were very much disputed later. The finger streaks were said to be Sarah's. They said to be Sarah's as she supposedly clawed out of the tub. And then the argument is, what, wouldn't she claw at her attacker instead of clawing at the tub? So, you can look at this two ways.
What I meant with my assertion was that it seemed that the kind of ploys that, say, a defense would use and say that it was a vigorous defense are some of the kinds of things that the prosecution put forth, trying to string certain seemingly insignificant things together as sort of circumstantial evidence. And so it seemed like that, again, with the dramatic bathtub, a lot of the things seemed to be ploys that I would usually see defense attorneys using, not the other way around.
Well, it's interesting that you make that observation because at one point the prosecution actually tried to get the trial moved out of the county, a change of venue, which most of the people I've talked to and in my own experience, that is, again, something that the defense usually does. And from what I understand, they believe that public opinion was against them in this particular case. And so that was why that they were trying to get the case moved out of the county. But that didn't happen.
Now, at this first trial, again, it seems like that normally they would have an issue not having any kind of real motive. So what was the prosecution at trial? What was their theory about the motive, and what was the evidence they put forth towards that, if any?
Well, the only glimmer, and I mean just a tiny sliver of some information that hinted at a motive, there were two things. They put out this information that Sarah Widmer had applied for a life insurance policy. However, there was no life insurance in place at the time of her death, so there was no fat life insurance check that he was going to collect if he would, you know, kill her and then get away with it, sort of thing. The other, but again, that was kind of it seemed to me to be fairly well neutralized by the defense because that was their argument that, you know, how is this guy going to benefit from her death? That, you know, she actually applied for it. And there was some testimony that Ryan was putting pressure on her to get this life insurance. However, this didn't come out in trial, but I thought it was interesting. I found out later that the couple had met with a financial planner. And most people who've ever done that know that, you know, planning for unfortunately, one person or the other dying is an important thing to take care of. And it was a benefit available through her work. So that life insurance never took effect. The other thing that was raised again as a kind of a sliver of a motive during the case was Sarah's mother testified that she was out with her daughter once and that Ryan called her immediately after she made a purchase, I believe at Target. I don't remember if Sarah's mother said Target, but I believe Ryan told me that later and friends told me this later. And kind of, according to the mother, gave her crap over, you know, hey, what are you doing spending $100 at Target? You need to spend $100 at Target. But that was couched as being a joke, that a lot of people joke, a lot of couples or, you know, women who like to shop or whatever say, hey, I can't get out of Target without spending $100. So, again, was it him being controlling, him, you know, kind of monitoring her financial transactions, or was it instead just an innocent joke? Now, people who knew Ryan insisted that that it was a joke, that Ryan was kind of a goofball personality, and that you know, Sarah would say jump, and he would say how high. And she made more money than he did. So, again, they're saying this makes zero sense, that she makes more money and he's coming down on her for expenditures. So that was the only, you know, they weren't able to really bring out much of any motive. Now, they're not required under the law. The prosecution isn't required to prove motive, but it sure helps a jury to justify a verdict.
Right. And there was any witness to testify to any temper, anger, any kind of violent behavior, disposition, anybody from work? They talked to everybody at where he worked, where Ryan worked. Anything from that?
Actually, quite the opposite. They went way back into Ryan's childhood, and I think they found a kid who knew Ryan when he was 10 and said he was upset at a baseball game or something. But he was described as being one of the most passive and laid back. That I heard that term laid back many, many times as I did my interviews, and as well as, you know, the testimony of people who knew Ryan and Sarah would say that about Ryan, that he was very laid back, that, you know, Sarah would say, I want to do this, and he would just acquiesce because it kind of wasn't worth to him arguing. And plus, he, according to everybody, doted on her and just wanted to please her, was one of his primary missions in life. Yes, yes, dear, yes, dear. So quite a different portrayal from the people who knew Ryan than people who would look at that Target expenditure, for example, and assume that he was a control freak.
Now, his attorney, which is interesting because this will be very interesting, I think, near the end of this book and this interview, his attorney was an attorney named Charles Ridger. And Ridger really believed in his, which I thought was, again, unusual. You don't hear about a lawyer, an attorney, defending somebody really pushing to find out the truthfulness of their client's story, I just thought.
Yes. In fact, Charlie Ridger was somebody just like the many of the other players in this case that I knew at least somewhat outside the confines of this case before the case began. And I had the type of rapport with Charlie where I had the confidence that he was a great interview because he would sort of tell me some things off the record to help me understand context. And as a reporter, you always appreciate that. But one of the problems was when this case actually went – before it went to trial, there was a gag order issued. So it prevented Charlie from even talking to me or anybody else off the record at that point. None of the players, Rachel Hutzel, the police, everything was clamped down at one point. But Charlie, to this day, has very strongly defended Ryan. And in fact, was part of when I did the launch of my book last year, he spoke out and said that he really strongly believes that some of the evidence that didn't come out during the trial should be released. So that was kind of, to this day, he stands by Ryan.
You talk about something I thought was surprising. Well, I found it surprising that, and I think a lot of people might have this attitude in some way, at least a bias anyway, about Ryan taking the stand at that first trial in his own defense. What was your attitude? What are other people's attitude, and what happened in that regard?
Well, of course, any time a defendant takes the witness stand in his or her own defense, everybody wants to hear what this person has to say.
Sure.
And early on in my career, I think I had an attitude similar to probably most people in the general public, which is, you know, hey, if I were accused of something I didn't do it, nothing would stop me from getting up there and proclaiming my innocence. I would be stomping my feet and pounding my fists and talking about how innocent I am. However, I did later come to learn that even the most passionate defense from a defendant, a lot of times a jury may not tend to even care about that very much, because there does seem to be in a lot of jurors' minds a tendency to think, well, this person, if they sound polished, it's because they're rehearsed. If they don't sound polished and they stutter and stammer and they are upset and crying, well, that's because they're guilty, and that's their guilty conscience showing up on the witness stand.
Yeah.
So a lot of people were wanting to hear, because there were a lot of missing, a lot of gaps in the whole storyline that it seemed like the lawyers were kind of trying to hint at through their questions. But what was Ryan's actual story? And when he didn't take the witness stand, there were quite a few people who said that it was because he certainly must have something to hide. And I wasn't so sure of that. I thought that was quite possible, but I also thought it was possible that there might be some other explanation. And later I learned that there was.
Let's use this, Janice, as an opportunity to stop for a second to talk about our sponsor, FabFitFun. The 2019 FabFitFun Summer Box is on sale now. Treat yourself with items in it, such as the Via Paula Hermione Lotus Towel and the Jennifer Zuner Star Double Necklace and Kula Organic SPF 30 Makeup Setting Sunscreen Spray. Do you love discovering new products? Are you a beauty and fashion maven constantly on the hunt for the next best thing? Ever read about or spot something online that you've always wanted to try but never have? Then you must try FabFitFun. FabFitFun allows women everywhere to discover new products, as well including rave review, must-have brands that you know and love. It's like Christmas four times a year. Full-size products, no samples of anything. Every box is guaranteed to have over $200 in retail value. The 2019 Summer Box total retail value equals $269.95 to $467.95. Great for discovering new brands and products. What a better way to shop. My wife Lisa received her 2019 Summer Box, and like I mentioned, she got a Vicks Paula Hermione Lotus Towel she just loved, and the Jennifer Zuner Star Double Necklace, and the Kula Organic SPF 30 Makeup Setting Sunscreen Spray. Lisa always loves to be surprised with great new products, and she loved this Summer Box and can't wait to get her new one, her next one, FabFitFun Box. Sign up for FabFitFun today. These boxes always sell out. Use my code MURDER to get $10 off your first box. Go to FabFitFun.com to sign up and start getting the box for a life well lived. Use promo code MURDER to get $10 off your first box. That's over $200 for only $39.99. Go to FabFitFun.com and use my code MURDER to get $10 off your first FabFitFun box. Now, Janice, we are at the culmination of the first trial, because there are, as the story does not end at the first trial or the appeals, And certainly we've alluded to that in the introduction. So tell us what happens in this first trial. What did you expect? What did the public expect? And then what happened? And tell us about the charge that murder, guilty of murder, but the aggravated murder. Tell us about that distinction.
Okay, so the jury in this case deliberated, by local standards, quite a long time, about 23 hours before they came back with the decision. And actually, for anybody who was in that courtroom at the moment that the verdicts were read, it was one of the most visceral, powerful experiences I will never, ever forget. And I know anyone else who was there would agree with it, because originally the courtroom was actually packed with Ryan's supporters. And in fact, I remember trying really hard to find anybody who was there for Sarah, which made me kind of sad. But a lot of the people that were friends with Ryan and Sarah were very supportive of Ryan. They thought he should be acquitted. And there were two charges that were available to the jury to decide. One of them was aggravated murder. Now, aggravated murder under the state of Ohio law says that the person had some premeditation, even if it was only for a few moments. It doesn't have to be planned months in advance and I've got poison or whatever. The person, you know, it is you have an opportunity to kind of stop yourself and then you don't. There's some premeditation. You think for at least some time, it could be a momentary premeditation that you purposely kill another person. So that particular charge, the first verdict was on that charge. And it was not guilty. The courtroom actually erupted in tears, like sighs of relief. And the judge put out his hand, like, stop, to shush everyone. And then everybody was absolutely, I remember my hands were shaking so hard, I could hardly type. It was a very strange thing because I didn't have any dog in this hunt. I didn't per se, have any, feel like, oh, Ryan Whitmer should be convicted or Ryan Whitmer should be acquitted. I was kind of puzzled and didn't really know what direction the jury would go, because I found myself kind of going back and forth, like, did he or didn't he? It was a very, I was on the edge. And I think a lot of people were that way. And I also think, though, that because of that back and forth, that there were a lot of people who said, okay, well, maybe he did it, but they didn't prove it. So that was a pretty strong sentiment among some people in the community. In fact, there was a poll later that did show that most people thought Ryan should not have been convicted. So when that second verdict was read and it was guilty, the cheers and elation that were literally a moment or two earlier just changed to this complete anguish. People were wailing and crying, and somebody shouted out small town justice, and Ryan's uncle slammed open the courtroom door and like just burst out of the court in disgust. Convict an innocent man. And there was just all these, it was an absolute cauldron of emotion boiling over. I get chills even right now telling you about it. Just being there in that room with those emotions flip-flopping like a light switch, absolutely unforgettable. And then when Ryan Whitmer had the opportunity to address the court, it was absolute. People were just completely like hit in the gut, and that's how he appeared. He doubled over. And then he said, I did not do this. He said it in present tense, which struck me. I love my wife. Almost as though he was in denial that she was dead. That's how I interpreted it. And that's how some other people interpreted it as well. I love my wife. I would never hurt her. And he was tearful and shaking his head. No, no, no. Again, courtroom verdicts are often emotional, but to have absolute elation one moment and then flip-flop into this anguish on the part of the majority of the people who were spectating there, that's pretty much unheard of in my experience. It was absolutely incredible, unforgettable, sad. And it was even hard, like I said, for me to take notes and to send a message to my editor and say, okay, put this out on Twitter. Here's what happened.
Yeah. Tell us about the media and public response after this. And then tell us about this John C. juror and what almost happens in terms of juror misconduct.
Well, the newspaper did a poll that asked people, do you think that the jury got it right? And a large percentage of the people said no. They thought that based on what was reported from this case, now, you know, you hear a lot of criticisms of media, and a lot of those criticisms are founded. I agree with that. But in this case, one of the things that was sort of unusual, at least locally, and at that time, remember, this was, you know, almost 11 years ago now. Actually, I take it back. The trial was in 2009. So it was 10 years ago this year that the trial happened. And things have changed a lot in these 10 years. Back then, it was a really big deal that one of the local TV stations started a live blog. So this guy in the court was sitting there typing in testimony, a lot of it verbatim, and he developed almost like a cult following. So a lot of people, it was the first time I can remember in our, you know, area of the country that people had the opportunity to kind of real time follow a local case like this. And it was interesting because the judge forbade any live TV broadcasts. So this was kind of a way around that, right? So there was one TV camera in the courtroom, and that it was by Dateline NBC, and they were required to share their footage with all the other local media each day, but they were not allowed to broadcast live. So what happens after that is shortly after this verdict, one of the jurors, a guy named John first initial C, comes forward and says, something's been really bothering me. He actually kept a journal that he later shared with the court about his misgivings about the verdict and the way it happened. He actually revealed he ended up faxing Charlie Rickers, that defense lawyer, and saying, there's something I'd like to talk to you about the case. If you want to talk to me, you know, give me a call back. So he ends up talking. The lawyer, of course, talks to the guy, and he comes out and says, well, you know that instruction where the judges tell the jury that you're only allowed to decide this case based on what is presented in court? Well, I'm kind of concerned that maybe that rule was violated because some of the jurors did home experiments on how long it takes a body to air dry. Remember I told you about the dryness of Sarah's body as observed? People wanted to know how long does it take a body to air dry. And so literally some of them would shower and then either allow themselves to drip dry, and reportedly at least one juror ended up on the carpet lying down and trying to see how long it takes to dry, to see if Ryan's story and all of the events recorded on this 911 call tracked with the dryness of the body as observed by those first responders when they first got there. And so this is pretty much an absolute no-no. And although the prosecution fought mightily and there were months of court battles that ensued after this, at least 500 pages of documents were filed after this, and there were affidavits from some jurors saying that, yes, this changed my vote, and other jurors saying, look, this was such a small part of the deliberations, it didn't really even matter. And eventually, though, this resulted in the verdict being thrown out. So now Ryan Widmer is back in the position of being supposedly innocent until proven guilty. He's just now a suspect again. He's no longer convicted. He was in prison for these first few months after the verdict, and then he's released on bond. And guess what? The family had to pony up the money again because
the first bond is now null and void and over with, and they're just out that money. A lot of people don't know that. When you post bond, you just lose that money. It can't be applied to something again later, and you don't get that money back if the guy shows up for trial, for example. It's just payment, period. So then, some people thought, will the prosecution even try to go to a second trial? And they were, oh, yes, certainly we're going for a second trial. So that's what happened next.
Now, what was the improvements in that second trial? And just to say, when we talked about the money, we'll just skip ahead to how much money Gary and Kim and the family spent. But Gary, the long-distance father of Ryan, ponied up quite a bit, took out his retirement funds. Kim, his wife, was very supportive, even though she was not his stepmom at all. She didn't even know Ryan. You talk about $500,000 by the second trial.
Yes, eventually that is what the family estimated that they ended up spending in legal fees, in expert witness fees, bond, paying electronic monitoring fees for the ankle bracelet that when he was released on bond, he originally had to have that, and there was a pretty hefty fee associated with that. There were a lot of costs that this family absorbed, and they're just kind of an ordinary family. Although I will say Ryan's mother, she was kind of a remarkable lady in my opinion. I didn't get to know her very well, but gosh, she started out as a secretary at this one company, ends up becoming the vice president of marketing for an international company. So that's pretty impressive from a person who starts as a secretary. That's a person who has some chutzpah. And she fought mightily and absolutely defended her son. She just said, I don't care. She lived by our standards here, it was a pretty, very, very nice home in one of the most upscale subdivisions in the region. It was over $300,000 home. She remortgaged that. She dipped into her own retirement and depleted all of it. She was willing to risk everything for her son because she absolutely believed in him. What was very interesting, too, to me, was the fact that even though Ryan's parents were divorced, both his parents described Ryan as being their favorite son. They said there was a sweetness to Ryan, which doesn't seem to track with convicted killer. They both thought he was a very sweet person. But then again, we've all seen people who seem to be very sweet on one side, and then on the other, there's something very sinister. I didn't know these people at all, but I'm just telling you, this is what was relayed to me. And I did find it to be significant that both parents, even though they had three children, for whatever reason, Ryan just endeared themselves to people. And he was kind of, again, a goofball kind of person who, happy-go-lucky goofball personality that people who, when they got to know him, did seem to really like him.
Right. You talk about this second trial, and of course the prosecution has opportunities to learn from the first trial, but so does the defense. There are some new additions, obviously, new attorneys for the second trial. The prosecution stays essentially the same. It's interesting, I thought, and maybe you could tell us your take on it being there, the prosecution seemed to be bolstering a much stronger case in the second trial, with experts like Dr. Smile.
Dr. Smile was actually one of the defense experts, and he actually testified in the first trial. Yeah. What was interesting, definitely both sides upped their game in this second trial, but based on the comments that were being made by, quote-unquote, the legal experts. Remember I told you about that gag order? Well, when there's a gag order, as a reporter, you're kind of forced to go to some outside sources. For example, a former county prosecutor who was in the Cincinnati area, a lot of us relied on him for commentary. There were other attorneys who were actually attending the trial who ended up providing some interviews for interview-starved reporters. And it was the second trial involved a new legal team, and a lot of people wondered why that happened. Well, part of it is because it's kind of, you know, in some ways it's hard to kind of second guess your own work, but
sure.
I think that the trial actually just took a huge toll. In fact, I know it did on Charlie Ricker's health even. He fervently believed in Ryan's innocence and felt awful that he had somehow failed Ryan with that guilty verdict. And then when they were able to get that verdict overturned, he felt like, okay, let's let someone else have a crack at this. I think that was the consensus of pretty much everybody involved on Ryan's side of it. So they, the new set of lawyers, three lawyers, went, you know, full on attack mode against the emergency responders. They really nitpicked apart every single document, every mistake, every, any little anything that just didn't seem consistent or seemed sloppy. They were hammering home those points. So, and the prosecution, though, they saw some of the things that the, and I know that they were following live blogs and they were following the comments from the public. And so that enabled them to kind of tighten up some things that they were doing. For example, I believe that they got a different, in fact, I know they got a different expert witness to talk about whether Sarah could have fallen asleep. And this was a person then who could talk not just about the alleged falling asleep as being preposterous, but about some other possible scenarios, and an expert who could address not just the alleged falling asleep. Although, again, the defense, I will say, never alleged that Sarah fell asleep. They just said that was Ryan's supposition. That was his theory, his way of perceiving what happened. Again, if you believe that he's making a cover story for murder, that's one thing. Or you might believe what the defense says, which is that he just perceived that she had possibly fallen asleep because that's what she did. She fell asleep all the time.
Right.
So both sides did tighten up their game quite a bit in that second trial, but it actually got very heated and very contentious in there. It was a quite different nature, and I think that anybody who saw the two trials, it was very, very different in character. It was a lot more contentious.
You say the defense had the three attorneys, and you talk about attorney Ehrenstein being eloquent, basically, compared to the prosecution, which was Vue. And what was your estimation and other people's, you know, court watchers' estimation of what might happen in this case as opposed to the first one? What thought was the difference, and what were the possibility of the outcome in people's minds?
According to the experts that we were all interviewing, the consensus seemed to be that the prosecution was kind of on its heels a lot of the time. They, you know, even when, as you know, the prosecution presents their evidence first, and then the defense gets to present their witnesses. So during the prosecution's case, the defense was really scoring a lot of points by those attack mode that I was describing. Their attack mode was just really pretty strong and started to create a lot of doubt about the perhaps competency and or, you know, how observant some of these people really were, things along those lines, just creating a lot of doubt, which is their job to poke holes in the prosecution's theory of what happened here. And the consensus was that maybe Ryan Widmer would come out of this with a not guilty verdict. But that didn't happen.
Tell us about the verdict and the response. Again, you said the first time was surreal. So tell us what happened in the second time. And we really haven't spoken about, other than Ryan, tell us more about Ryan's response in the second trial.
Well, the second trial ended after over 30 hours of deliberations with a hung jury, because under the law, the jurors in a case like this have to decide unanimously either guilty or not guilty. If they cannot get everyone to agree, then it's a hung jury, and guess what? A third trial comes along possibly, or the prosecution could decide, hey, I'm throwing up my hands, you know, maybe get this person a plea deal or whatever. Now, what happened here was a lot of people in the community were, I like to use the term Widmered out. They were exhausted by the emotional roller coaster of this case, and people followed it super closely, very, very closely. And Ryan's reaction in this case, he just said, well, obviously, he didn't really say a whole lot at the end of this one, but some reporters caught him as he was walking away from the courthouse, and he said, well, obviously, I should have found not guilty. But I think that in his mind and in the mind of a lot of his supporters and lawyers, that they were getting closer. They went from a guilty verdict to at least a hung jury with some more people, you know, in his court, his corner, so to speak, among the jurors. And there was a big dispute about how many jurors actually would have been in his, you know, willing to vote not guilty, because there was no actual vote taken, and there was a lot of controversy and confusion over that. But what was very fascinating and very unusual, several of the jurors that voted or would have voted if they had actually taken a vote, a final vote, that would have voted not guilty, came to the third trial. And they actually had provided affidavits that were trying to discourage the prosecution from proceeding because, in the words of one juror, quote, it was like they gave us a bunch of crap evidence and said, you figure this out. Because as I mentioned earlier, the prosecution's theory about what happened here, they offered several different, well, it could have been this, it could have been that, it could have been in the bathtub, the toilet, the sink. I mean, it went kind of all over, but then they ended up kind of settling on the bathtub. But still, there were some jurors who said, oh, I think it happened in the toilet because only her head was wet. But there was no evidence presented about the toilet, which was so weird to me. How do you end up thinking that? Again, it was a very bizarre case in so many ways.
You talk about that it looks for the defense that they're making headway. So the third trial, they try to avoid a third trial, and they think that the prosecution can be pressured in certain ways. So there are a couple strategies they do, a couple attempts at things so that they can even avoid this third trial because they're obviously more confident. Tell us what happens with those motions and those strategies to do that. And then the third trial, again, the players that are for defense and for prosecution with this third trial.
So one of the things that the defense complained about was they had learned during that second trial that Sarah Widmer had filled out a document at her work that said that she had a heart murmur when she was a child. And all the previous testimony was portraying her as being a relatively healthy 24-year-old woman with just some allergies and stuff, like no big deal. But then people wondered, gee, well, was this heart murmur something that could have played a role in her death? It actually later came out that a recommended follow-up of that heart murmur, which was discovered when she was an infant, was never done. So, again, we have a bunch of question marks that can never be answered. Like that one. Did Sarah really have some kind of a heart issue? Because she was never, if you don't have an EKG, a lot of heart issues are not apparent, maybe with just a stethoscope, for example. So it could be, you know, some could be. But again, there were no specific tests ever done outside of that one EKG when she was a child, and then the EKG that was done, which unfortunately she was, what would they call, flatline. She never ever regained a pulse while the paramedics were trying to work on her, other than, of course, the compressions they do on her chest during the CPR. So, they did try to get some, say, hey, look, we don't believe, because of these affidavits from these jurors, that any jury could ever reach a verdict because of the state of the evidence here. There's just too many unanswered questions. But the judge didn't allow that. Then they also were trying to really attack that Lieutenant Detective Jeff Braley that we mentioned at the very beginning of our talk today.
Yes.
A lot of information had come out about his background that raised questions about his credibility, but the judge just would not allow that into the trial. So another very interesting thing, and this was not something that the defense fought for, but rather the prosecution offered Ryan Widmer a plea deal. And I didn't know this until later. and he flat out turned it down. In fact, according to the people who were in the room with Ryan when his dad was there, I interviewed him, and the one lawyer was there, I interviewed him, and they said that the lawyer could barely get the words out. Hey, you know, hear me out. He's like, no, I'm not going to admit to something I didn't do. So some people would look at that as being compelling evidence that, or not compelling evidence, but a compelling sign that perhaps Ryan Widmer is really innocent. But then other people could look at that and say, wonder if he thought he could just outsmart everybody and beat this. So again, there just about everything in this case, everything that looks one way, you flip it over and you can look at it almost as compellingly the second way.
We move ahead to February 2nd, 2011, at this third trial. A promise of a mystery witness is out there, so everyone's intrigued, and it's a Jennifer Jean Crew. Tell us a little bit about this supposed witness and her testimony, what she offers.
Well, well, I've got to tell you, it created quite a lot of intrigue when the prosecution, prior to this case going to the trial for a third time, filed a document that said that they had a new witness. People were just rampant with speculation. A lot of people thought it was a jailhouse snitch and that Ryan Widmer had somehow admitted, when he was in prison or, you know, before he got out after that verdict was overturned, had admitted to somebody, or somebody else was speculating that maybe it was somebody in his family and, that he confided in. And as it turns out, they kept this identity secret until the trial, after the jury was actually selected and seated, there was a recess, which then allowed the defense to check into the background of this witness. And I later found out that they, of course, asked their client, who in the world could this be that, the prosecution's alleging that you confessed to this person that you did this.
Yeah.
He's like, I didn't confess to no one. I confessed to no one. What do you mean? And so this witness comes forward and says that, she testified that during a phone call that she's at her home in Iowa and that Ryan Widmer admitted that he killed his wife and that he sounded drunk and upset. So the defense puts on a witness who had spoken to Ryan. Ryan had phone calls, emails from across the country. A lot of these people are females, and it makes it look like he's some kind of Casanova, and that was how some of the local radio talk show hosts portrayed him. But as I got to know Ryan, he's pretty much – I would not describe him that way. goofball personality is closer than Casanova. So, this other woman was on the phone with him in a call that concluded 6 minutes before the phone call where he allegedly confessed. And he was, according to her, neither drunk nor upset. And then it comes out that this mystery witness actually was on methadone and had a history of some convictions for some minor offenses involving not being truthful. And so there were a lot of things that were raised as to her credibility. And the jurors that I spoke to universally told me they pretty much discounted everything she said. They did not find her credible. And it was interesting to me, though, that if you don't find this person credible and it's being touted that this is almost like the star witness, doesn't that make you doubt the entire prosecution's case? But that wasn't what happened.
Tell us what happens at this verdict February 15th, 2011.
So actually, we were already, everybody was assuming and kind of preparing for an extra long deliberation because the trend was up. First trial, 23 hours of deliberations. Second trial, 30 hours. Third trial, I'm putting my money on at least maybe 40 hours because this was the longest trial yet. And each trial got longer and more complex. And I thought, it's going to take them a long time to go through all this evidence. And, maybe they won't reach a decision for like 40 hours. People were shocked when this jury came back in 12 hours and it was guilty. People were absolutely shocked. Now, there were some people that believed this witness, or at least thought it was unsavory that Ryan was having communication with these various women across the country, and that didn't look good, and maybe he was having an affair with his wife or something like that was going on behind the scenes. And so that started to fuel some more anti-Widmer sentiment about Ryan Widmer. It was just – it was a very similar reaction to – but it wasn't that same outburst that was – that happened during that first trial, but Ryan responded again very similarly, shaking his head, saying, "I didn't do this," protesting his innocence, and he does to this day.
Yes, incredible. Now, there is a secret that you have in here that Ryan had a son and he had a relationship after his conviction, and after his first conviction, I should say, while he was out on bond, and he has a son. From this woman at that time, they had a relationship. But you have the first, other than Dateline, but you're the first reporter that was able to get an interview with Ryan. And so you describe in the book how you set the parameters on how this interview is going to go. He's not going to set the rules. So what are the rules that you set before you're going to interview him, the grounds on which you were to interview him? What does he agree to? And tell us just a little bit about that interview.
Well, there weren't really a lot of rules or anything like that. I just basically said, look, the only thing I'm going to promise you is that I will tell your story more fully than Dateline. Dateline just gave him a little tiny snippet toward the end of a two-hour special. And I just said, look, I'm going to interview you. I didn't really set any rules other than, look, I'm going to ask you every question that I can within the time that the prison allows us. And it became very interesting to me. This was the first time that I really had a chance to talk to Ryan because of the gag order. I think I had said hello to him a couple of times during the course of all of this. It was almost surreal because obviously Ryan was somebody I saw every day for days on end during all three trials. And he saw me every day for days on end during the three trials, but we were never allowed to talk until this moment when I'm in visiting with him in prison along with a photographer from the Inquirer. And one of the things that became apparent to me, when you have one of those light bulb moments in life where you say, aha, I had always wondered a little bit, despite what I said about the fact that I know that there are valid reasons why someone might not testify, and there are also suspicious reasons why someone might not testify in his or her behalf. It became apparent to me during this interview why Ryan didn't testify. When he stated to me, you can't jump to a gun like they did with me, I knew what he meant. And it wasn't sure. Just that. There were several things like that. There was like a pattern of speech with Ryan that made it clear to me that he just doesn't present super well. And that kind of odd sentence structure would make some jurors wonder about whether he was being honest, perhaps. And with his permission, I said, hey, I would like to talk to your lawyers. Will you give me permission? He said, yes. And I asked, and universally, all of the lawyers said that is why they did not put him on the witness stand, because he had a tendency to misspeak, to correct himself, which just doesn't come across very well if you're on the witness stand. And he might say right when he meant to say left. And I didn't have the impression that he had that he's stupid or anything. I actually think Ryan Widmer is a fairly intelligent guy. He was a pretty good student in school, from what I understand. But he's just one of those people for whom communicating isn't necessarily verbally isn't their strong suit. I think that his communication has improved over the years, but at that time, the very first interview I did with him in 2011, it was obvious to me that there were some communication glitches, as I would like to call them, that would make him be not the best presentable witness, just doesn't come across as being super polished. Mm-hmm. So I kind of figured out in my own head that jump to a gun. He actually thinks so quickly, I think, that he will put together two phrases that are similar. For example, in that case, jump to a gun may have been the result of jump to conclusions and jump the gun melded together. That was
sure.
the theory that I kind of developed after I noticed his communication patterns.
He also had a strong case from the defense point of view, and so I would think that when a defense attorney says there's no way I would put that guy on the stand, considering the case that they had and considering the things you just said about him as a witness, but that's at least 50% of it as well. They have a case they believed in. There was no need to jeopardize it with him on a witness stand and no need really in their minds to have him up there really anyway. I wanted
exactly. That was
you.
What they said. Huh? Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. So Ryan Widmar remains in prison. This book has come out. And you mentioned also that the Free Ryan Widmar Facebook page is still active, 60,000 or 6,000 members. So it's still this case is still in the public view.
Well, that Facebook page was still active at the time, but apparently the gentleman who was policing that took it down for some reason. But there is a website called freeryanwidmar.org where the supporters have started a petition to try to get the prosecution to turn over Sarah Widmar's DNA so it can be tested for some of the disorders that were suspected for her, that were these tests were never done, which is, again, big fat question mark in this case. Is it possible that she may have suffered from some of these disorders? That there's one in particular that she has a lot in common with: a cleft palate, low set ears, small lower jaw, and a possible heart rhythm disturbance, which can be associated with drownings. According to the Mayo Clinic, the first sign of this disorder in a family could be an unexplained drowning, but yet she was never tested for this disorder. Isn't that interesting?
Yes, absolutely. You write in this book, the case began when Sarah was found submerged, or when Sarah was submerged, and that you fear now this is also what happened to the truth. I want to thank you very much for coming on and adding to the biggest picture and explanation of this case that is possible. Submerged, Ryan Widmar, his drowned bride, and the justice system. I want to thank you very much, Janice Heisel, for coming on and talking about Submerged. Is there a Facebook page or website that people might go to for more information?
Yes, they can go to thesubmergedbook.com, or they can find the Facebook page that's called Submerged, Ryan Widmar, his drowned bride, and the justice system. On that page, I do post some updates about some things relevant to this case. For example, there's something that I just ran across about bathtub drownings and how hard they are to investigate. I'm going to be posting that very soon. And I have just things of interest to people who have been following this case and the criminal justice system and changes in journalism.
Thank you very much, Janice Heisel, for coming on and talking about Submerged. You have a great evening. Thank you. Good night.
Thank you, Dan. Appreciate it. Mm-hmm.
Good night.
Thank you.